Radio EcoShock.
I'm Alex Smith. We're back with Vicki Wyatt. We're talking about Arctic drilling off the coast of Greenland with the Scottish company Cairn Energy. So this company is small. It wouldn't have the resources, the money, or the equipment to clean up if something like a BP Deepwater Horizon accident happened off Greenland.
That's right. So, for example, BP last year, when the spill happened in the Gulf of Mexico, had something like 14,000 ships, a huge amount of money. It cost them something like $40 billion to contain and clean up. Initially the spill. Cairn have nowhere near those kinds of resources. Last year when they were drilling in the Arctic, they had no more than 20 vessels in the near vicinity of where they were drilling. So to think that they would be able to respond on the same scale is pie in the sky. And added to that, the Arctic is obviously very different. It's much colder, which means the oil behaves differently. It's very remote, which means it would be much more difficult to get help out there to try and contain the spill. But most importantly, as we know, the Arctic freezes over. So there's a very short space of time during which they can drill. And so if there were to be a spill, they would only have a very short time to be able to drill the relief well, which is a new well which would enable them to cap the well with the problem. And there's no way they would be able to drill that relief well before the ice covered over. So they'd have to wait till the following year. So in essence, that means you'd have a couple of years of a gushing well into the Arctic wilderness before anybody would be able to get to it and cap it anyway.
Who gave them permission to drill there?
Well, the Greenland government is responsible for licensing oil in the region, but you know, we have to keep the focus as well on the oil companies here. It's these companies that are going to the ends of the earth, to places like the Arctic, to look for oil and drill for oil. And, you know, we really need to see a signal from governments across the world that this isn't the energy source that we want to go after, that we need to be turning our attention to investing in much cleaner sources of energy.
Well, how is Greenland governed and why are the Danes involved in this?
Well, Greenland isn't fully independent, and the Danish government has some jurisdiction over some areas of their government. But in terms of oil and licensing companies to drill and explore for oil in Greenlandic waters, that is a decision and a power that the Greenland government has themselves. But the Danish government, for example, is responsible for defense of Greenland and for its foreign policy.
But WikiLeaks has released some documents from the U.S. cable collection saying that U.S. diplomats believe Greenland, quote, is on a clear track to independence and see this as, quote, a unique opportunity for American gas and oil companies to get a foothold. That looks like America is watching to see whether they can get a chance at this Arctic gold mine.
Yes, and that's a really good point. And so the big powers, the US, Russia, and others, are eyeing up the Arctic. They want some of the oil that's there. And, you know, it's important that we remember this, that our dependence on oil is a dependence on a very insecure source of energy. Those WikiLeaks cables revealed the potential for armed conflict over these resources. Now, if countries don't want to go down that road, we need to start investing in cleaner sources of energy and not relying on oil, which is becoming increasingly hard to get and increasingly expensive, as well as the obvious concern around its role in driving climate change.
Vicki, what about the people who actually live there, the Inuit? They have a fishing industry in that strait, I'm told. Have they come up with some worries on this one?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's another good point. An oil spill, as we saw in the Gulf of Mexico, had a devastating impact on the fisheries and tourism industry there. And so whilst oil companies love to showcase the economic benefits that, for example, drilling in Greenland could have for the Greenland economy and for the Greenland people, it's not really the Greenland people who will see the bumper profits that oil exploration will produce. But yet it's the Greenland people that will have to carry the risks and pick up the consequences, for example, if there were to be a spill.
I was reading some news about this cairn oil drilling experiment, I would call it, and it sounded like they had to tow away icebergs every day from the drilling area. It's called Iceberg Alley. Can you tell us about that risk?
Some of the wells that they're drilling, there are huge icebergs floating past, and they have to use a number of methods to make sure that a catastrophic incident doesn't happen. So, for example, they will have vessels that tow icebergs away from the drill site. They'll use water cannons to try and change the direction of a floating iceberg. I mean, this is a real gamble with the Arctic and with the wildlife that lives there. And, you know, some of the pictures, for example, that our photographers that have taken that are out there just show the craziness of this situation. Here's a company that's drilling deep into the Arctic Ocean, that's water cannoning icebergs out of the way.
And then there's the problems of the big storms in that region. In November 1981, the most advanced drilling rig of its day, the Ocean Ranger, was sunk with all 84 hands dying. No rescue was possible in those waters. This Greenland drilling must be just as unsafe for the workers.
The weather out there is certainly extreme and poses a huge threat to the safety of these operations. For example, climbers are hanging right now in a pod off of an oil rig off of the shores of Greenland. Last year, our climbers had to come down because of the severe weather. This year, we've rigged a pod onto the bottom of the rig, so our climbers have a safer and more secure environment in which to take direct action. But yeah, the weather poses huge difficulties out there, you know, gale force winds, rough seas. And so it's important for people to remember this extreme environment in which oil companies are operating and the problems that poses. And not only are they drilling, you know, a mile and a half deep into the ocean, they're being buffeted around by extreme weather. And if there was a spill, that's going to have an impact.
Vicki Wyatt, scientists I talked to were shocked, some even afraid, when the ice peeled back so suddenly in 2007, and it has continued to set low records even in the winter of 2010. The last November, December, it was thinner than they've ever measured it. So don't you think it's just amazing and bizarre that the very carbon emissions that caused this ice to retreat is now bringing on the oil companies to make a buck out of even further global warming, it sounds to me?
Yes, well, this is the irony of the situation. I mean, it's madness. It's like pouring gasoline on a fire. The thing that is causing the Arctic to melt and the thing that's causing the Arctic to change as we know it is allowing companies such as Cairn Energy and others to go in there and explore more oil and squeeze the last drops of oil from these places.
Well, listeners, we have to take a little detour here. Our media failed to tell us that carbon emissions are still growing so rapidly, we may have lost all hope of maintaining this ice on the Earth. The International Energy Agency, and it's hardly regarded as anything environmental, has warned the supposedly safe limit of 2 degrees C warming is, quote, a nice utopia. That's according to IEA chief economist Fatih Birol. Vicki, I thought the recession in the West reduced global carbon emissions. Now we find they rose above 30 gigatons in 2010, a new record. What is happening with emissions?
The figures that indicate that the emissions are rising and peaking is obviously very alarming, but so is the IEA's response, and it's exactly that kind of thinking that is getting us into this mess in the first place. The idea that 2 degrees, limiting any rise in warming to 2 degrees, is now out of our reach. The fact is that we still have time to make choices, to invest in cleaner energy, to go beyond oil, that could limit warming to below a 2 degree increase. Politicians and governments across the world need to take action to ensure that the investment in cleaner forms of energy takes place. And the IEA's defeatism in the face and saying that there's nothing that we can do isn't true. Their politicians have the power. We're at a crossroads. We don't have to be pursuing drilling in the Arctic. We don't have to be ripping up Canada's forest to get to the tar sands beneath. And we don't have to be drilling miles deep into the ocean. These are choices that we are making, and there are other alternatives, cleaner alternatives that are out there that we could be investing in, and there's still time to to curb our carbon emissions and to allow economic sustainable growth by other means and not by chasing the last drops of oil.
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock from London. Our guest is Greenpeace climate campaigner Vicky Wyatt. Vicky, let's get to the fun but serious stuff. Tell us about the Greenpeace actions along the way and then now off the coast of Greenland. Maybe you could start by describing this drilling rig, the Leif Erikson.
So the Leif Erikson is the only drilling rig to be in the Arctic this summer, drilling for oil deep in the Arctic Ocean. It's about the size of a small cathedral. It's a huge, huge, rusty, ugly structure. And right now, two Greenpeace activists are hanging off of the rig right by the drill bit in a yellow capsule, and they're preventing the drilling rig from beginning to drill in the Arctic Ocean because we want to send a message to Cairn Energy and to the world that we can't keep trying to squeeze out the last drops of oil and we need to start investing in cleaner energy.
What Greenpeace ships are involved in this campaign?
We've got two Greenpeace ships up in the Arctic at the moment, the Esperanza and the Arctic Sunrise, and both are being closely shadowed by Danish naval ships and Danish helicopters watching our every move. The RIBS launched off of the Esperanza at the weekend to get our climbers near the rig and to safely secure the pod on the underside of the rig so that we could stop the drilling. And we've got nationalities from all across the world on the ships, from the UK, from Norway, from America. So it's a real international effort.
Are you getting good public support or is there much press coming out of this in Europe? Are people really paying attention to this issue in Europe?
Well, we've had a great response to our activists and to the action that we've done. And one thing that struck us at Greenpeace is that people are so angry that oil companies like Cairn are going up to the Arctic to drill for oil. The pictures of ships water canning icebergs out of the way, pictures of the wilderness and of the wildlife that's at stake up there, makes people realize the madness of companies going up there to squeeze out the last drops of oil and makes them question why there is such resistance to investing in cleaner sources of energy.
There's so many angles to this story. Is there something that I've missed that you'd like to add?
There are very simple things that we can do to stop places like the Arctic being put at risk. So it's not just about investing in cleaner sources of energy, but there are very simple technologies and measures out there that would mean that we can use less oil. So, for example, we can make the cars and vans that we drive much more efficient. And there are laws being discussed in Europe in the next few years that seek to do just that. And the car and oil companies have lobbied very, very aggressively against those laws because they want to keep us addicted to oil. They want to keep drilling in the Arctic because it makes them money. But what we're saying is there are measures that we can take that are good for people because they make the energy that we use cheaper. They make us use less of the expensive oil, and they're also good for the climate and will help us to reduce carbon emissions and prevent climate change.
You just heard from Greenpeace climate campaigner Vicky Wyatt on what may be the last battle to save a livable planet. Greenpeace is protesting an early effort by Cairn Energy to drill in the dangerous Arctic Channel off the west coast of Greenland. Vicky Wyatt, thanks so much for giving us this update.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Find out more at our blog, ecoshock.info. And you can go to greenpeace.org to follow and help this campaign to stop dangerous Arctic oil drilling.
Instead of just letting you and all your liberal listeners attack our glorious oil companies, our great American oil companies.
Serious climate scientists, whole academies of science from many countries now predict the world will warm by 4 degrees centigrade this century. That's about 10 degrees for those of you on Fahrenheit. That means hotter, meaner summers for you and me, more records, more heat deaths, more drought, and more crop loss. The little creatures are finely attuned to heat. It's a timing signal, a challenge, and for some, a threat of extinction.
Radio EcoShock.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We hear way too much about how climate change will impact humans. What will happen to our cities near the rising seas? What about our food supply? But what about all the other gazillion species sharing space on this little planet? Hardly a word about them. That's why I was pleased to hear of new scientific research into the heat tolerance of wild animals. Can they handle a 2, 3, or even 5 degree rise in temperature? And for that matter, how do animals really cope with heat? Our guests are PhD candidate Jennifer Sunday and Dr. Nicholas K. Dulvey, associate biology professor at Simon Fraser University in Canada, and he's co-chair of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. Along with Amanda E. Bates from Deakin University in Australia, they've just published a paper in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. And don't let this title scare you off, Global Analysis of Thermal Tolerance and Latitude in Ectotherms. It's about the heat tolerance of animals. I'm hoping to find out how a thick-coated bear survives if summer starts to reach tropical levels, or maybe a hairless ape dressed in blue jeans. You can see how this matters. We have Nick Dulvey and Jennifer Sunday with us on the phone. Let's start with you, Jennifer. What was the big question that drove this research?
Well, the big question we wanted to answer is how animals' physiology changes as you look around the globe. And we wanted to address some key assumptions that people are making in how animals are adapted to the environment in which they live. In our case, we started out very humbly. We just had a few marine organisms that actually Amanda was looking at, and she was looking at some patterns in how their heat and their cold tolerance changed based on where she had collected them and with latitude. And we wanted to see how that would compare to other animals around the world. And so we started to collect this data set, and as we did it, we realized the importance of trying to test these patterns and how heat tolerance changes with, for example, in our case, latitude, and sort of how animals' physiology interacts with where they're actually found.
So if you throw, Jennifer, a bunch of marine animals into one tank and the tank's a certain temperature, do they all end up being happy there?
That's a good question. No, I mean, it does depend on, to some extent, where they're found. And one of the findings of our study was that marine organisms, and so if you're picturing taking marine organisms from different latitudes, they're not going to do as well if you try to put them in the same environment. But what we found with terrestrial organisms is, at least if you're looking at heat tolerance, that they're going to be able to survive nearly the same short-term heat shock, no matter where they were found in terms of latitude, so from the equator up to the poles.
Okay, well, let's go to Nick if we can.
Hi.
Hi, Nick. I see your interest in the conservation of nature, and there are many species expected to go extinct due to climate change. Do the results of this study have some bearing on that? Is there some way we can apply this?
Indeed. We heard a couple of years ago that, you know, somewhere around 20% of species are like on land are likely to go extinct due to climate change within the next 80 or so years. That's a prediction. It's not an observation. And that prediction was based on how shifting envelopes of temperature as they move northwards are going to bring animals with them and in actual fact carry them beyond the limits of continental land masses and into the ocean. So basically, butterflies disappearing into the ocean was the basis for that prediction. And the prediction's absolutely founded upon trying to understand the link between thermal physiology and geographic distribution. And while there are piecemeal studies of upper and lower limits to thermal tolerance in some species and in some locations, it's never been generally clear that there are some overall broad patterns. People have always questioned whether it's a feature of that particular group of frogs or that particular location. And you know what Jennifer's done that's incredibly novel in this area of ecology is not just to look at one case study in one location, but to bring together everybody's case studies and analyze them with a common framework to really understand if there is a general pattern across all of these cold-blooded organisms across the world. And, you know, this search for patterns is called macroecology, and the implication is that when we see such a strong common pattern that there will be some underlying mechanism that we'll be able to further understand. And, you know, so this is really a fundamental piece of research that helps us understand the basis linking seasonal variation in temperature to animals' capacity to cope with temperature at different locations around the world. So ultimately, this will all underpin better predictions of how species will respond to climate change in the future.
And do I understand you correctly that this paper was based on cold-blooded species as opposed to bears or other things?
That's correct. To be honest, we're pretty humble marine ecologists ourselves, so being dragged kicking and screaming into the realms of lizards, frogs and insects was a big leap already. But clearly, you know, this suggests that people studying the distribution and thermal physiology of warm-blooded organisms should get out and do a similar analysis for those species as well.
Jennifer, I'm told you didn't have to torture any animals under heat lamps to do this research. How did your team get the answers?
That's right. It turns out that people have been doing these studies throughout the century on their study organism or sort of a system that they're interested in. So all we did was collect all the data that we could find through the library and compile them and to sort of keep track of some of the important details of each study to make sure that we were accounting for different methodologies or things like that.
And this was about cold-blooded types of creatures. So did that include, for example, the insects?
Yeah, insects is a big part of the terrestrial part of our study, insects, frogs, and lizards.
And did you, in fact, find that there's a similar heat tolerance between those very different types of creatures?
We did. Our major question was how that heat tolerance changes with latitude. But as you suggest, when we put all of the heat tolerances of all of those animals on a plot, they're all relatively similar. But more importantly, the slope, so the decline with latitude, is the same in all of those animal groups, and it's not very much.
I don't think I really understood what you just said. So can you give me an example, perhaps?
So if you look at insects from Canada and the insects of, say, the same animal, same group down in Panama, we found that, and different species of related insects all the way through North America, we would find that the heat tolerance that they're able to, the high temperature that they're able to endure doesn't change with latitude. And then we would find the same pattern if we looked at frogs from high latitudes, mid latitudes, and down towards the equator. And again, their heat tolerance was similar to the insect tolerance, but more importantly, we found that heat tolerance didn't decline with latitude.
Nick, I'm wondering, we've just talked about how similar types of animals have similar types of heat tolerance, perhaps, and we're talking about latitude. Did I read correctly in the literature that an animal that's in the north might experience the same type of heat for a few days that an animal down at the equator might experience for many days, and so that's why they have to have a similar heat tolerance mechanism?
Indeed. So we think there are two possible explanations for this, you know, this similar heat tolerance across latitude. And the first one is, as you describe, that animals, even at the highest latitudes, do get exposed to heat shocks, even if only for a handful of days each year. And basically, they need to retain, there's an adaptive value to retaining really high heat tolerance because, you know, you don't have to be cooked for very long to die, which is a permanent loss of fitness. So you need some buffer to cope with that really high levels of extreme heat that occasionally happen, even at the highest latitudes.
And I remember reading a study about how so many of the creatures, including the ones you studied, have a similar body form. I mean, there's a body, there's legs, there's eyes. And so I'm wondering whether this heat tolerance is something that could have developed many, many long ages ago, and then nature, being very economical, just keeps that mechanism going, whatever it makes.
Indeed, and that's the other hypothesis. You know, if you think that the average species has a lifespan in the fossil record of about 1 million years. You know, 1 million years is a long time. It's a lot of climate change. Glaciers have expanded and retreated multiple times during the last 1 million years. And clearly, the link between the latitude or the number of degrees away from the equator and the temperature in degrees Celsius varies over evolutionary time. And of course, animals have tracked these isotherms up and down over the last tens and hundreds of thousands of years. So we think that this very high heat tolerance could also be an evolutionary legacy of glaciation cycles and so on. And if there's no real cost to retaining that high heat tolerance, then there's no reason to lose it. So at the moment, the challenge really is to try and understand to what degree, and it might vary between different groups, to what degree this high heat tolerance across latitudes is a result of an evolutionary legacy of multiple glaciations on land, or to what degree it's actually adaptive to help the species survive these very rare heat shocks that occur even at the highest latitudes.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith, and we're going to Jennifer Sunday. Your new study is about the heat tolerance of land species, but I've read that you've also done some research on another aspect of our carbon dumping, about how marine species adapt to ocean acidification. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I just presented at a conference a paper that's still under review, looking at how marine animals, coastal animals, are going to be able to potentially adapt evolutionarily to ocean acidification. So ocean acidification is sort of it's the elephant in the room for a lot of marine conservationists who are thinking about climate change because it's sort of the other CO2 problem. As the CO2 is released into the atmosphere, it's also being absorbed by the ocean, and it's a simple equilibrium, and the ocean is becoming more acidic through some changes in the carbon chemistry. We know that organisms are going to be affected. We can measure the effect in the laboratory, and we can say in about 100 years, this species is going to have a lower survival rate or a lower growth rate. But the outstanding question was if species are going to be able to adapt through evolution. So what we did was we tried to measure the genetic basis of the variation in how organisms react. So we looked at blue mussels and red urchins from our coast here in Western Canada. We measured the heritability of the traits that we were interested in, so how fast they can develop under a future acidified ocean. And then we did some simulations to see how quickly they'd be able to evolve.
Well, this is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking to two scientists, Jennifer Sunday and Nick Dolvey from Simon Fraser University, who, along with Amanda Bates down at Deakin University in Australia, have released a new paper on heat tolerance. And I'll put a link in my blog where you can find out a bit more about this. And I really appreciate both of you talking with us today.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
We have to wrap this show up. I never got to my big stack of jaw-dropping climate news. As Ellen LaConte wisely said, we humans must rise to the occasion. I'm Alex Smith. Get more from our website at ecoshock.org. Our show blog is ecoshock.info. Thank you for listening, and thank you for caring about your world.